Furthermore, intuition is always connected with something unselfish. If there is any touch of selfishness, shown in some impulse coming from a higher plane, we may be sure that it is an astral impulse and not a true Buddhic intuition. Intuition, somewhat analogous to the direct vision of the physical plane, eventually takes the place of reason, which may be compared to the physical plane sense of touch. Intuition develops out of reasoning in the same sequential manner, and without change of essential nature, just as the eye develops out of the sense of touch. But the intuition of the unintelligent is impulse, born of desire, and is lower, not higher, than reasoning. Chapter 15 Concentration. From what we have already seen regarding the mechanism and the power of thought, it is abundantly clear that the control of the mind is of far greater importance than is ordinarily supposed, both for a man's own sake and also for its influence on the work he is able to do for others. Thought control, in fact, is an essential prerequisite for the development of the powers of the soul. In the Voice of the Silence it is stated, "The mind is the slayer of the real, let the disciple slay the slayer." This does not, of course, mean that the mind must be destroyed, for one cannot get along without it, but that it must be dominated and mastered. It is not the man himself, but an instrument for him to train and use. Obviously the student must exercise the greatest care as to the thoughts and emotions he permits himself to entertain. The ordinary man rarely thinks of attempting to check an emotion, except, perhaps, in its external manifestation. When he feels it surging within him, he yields himself to it, and considers it natural to do so. The occult student, however, must adopt quite a different attitude. Instead of allowing his emotions to run away with him, he must take them absolutely under control, and this must be done by developing and controlling his mental body. One of the first steps towards this is the realization that the mind is not himself, but an instrument which he must learn to use. The student must thus set himself the task of mastering both his emotions and his mind. He must know exactly what he is thinking about, and why, so that he can use his mind, and turn it, or hold it still, just as a practiced swordsman turns his weapon where he will, in this direction or that, and is able to hold it as firmly as he wishes. In other words, he must acquire the power of concentration, which is a necessary preliminary to all mental work. He must learn to think steadily and consecutively, not allowing the mind to run suddenly from one thing to another, nor to fritter away its energies over a large number of insignificant thoughts. Most men find that all sorts of stray thoughts rush into their consciousness unbidden, and since they are quite unused to controlling the mind, they are powerless to stem the torrent. Such people do not know what real concentrated thought is, and it is this utter lack of concentration, this feebleness of mind and will, that makes the early stages of occult development so difficult to the average man. Furthermore, since in the present state of the world there are likely to be more evil thoughts than good ones floating about, this weakness lays a man open to all sorts of temptations which a little care and effort might have avoided altogether. On the form side, to concentrate is to keep the mental body shaped in one steady image. On the life side, it is to direct the attention steadily to this form so as to reproduce it within oneself. It is the force of the will which compels the mind to remain in one form, shaped to one image, completely disregarding all other impressions thrown upon it. More briefly, concentration consists in focusing the mind on one idea and holding it there. Still more simply, concentration is paying attention. If a man pays attention to what he is doing, then his mind is concentrated. The throat center, or chakram, while associated with the higher forms of hearing, is also closely associated with the power of paying attention, to which great importance is always attached in all occult systems. Hence, in the school of Pythagoras, for example, the pupils were kept for several years in the order called Akshtakoya, or hearers, and were strictly forbidden to launch out upon the perilous waters of originality until they were thoroughly grounded in the established principles of philosophy. For similar reasons, in the Mysteries of Mithra the lowest order was that of the ravens, signifying that they were allowed to repeat only that which they had heard, precisely as a raven or parrot does. The Freemason will recognize the correspondence of these orders with the degree of EA in his system. the S of the EA, which incidentally calls to the assistance of the man who uses it, a particular class of non-human intelligences of the subtle world, needs to be made correctly and at the proper place. If made carelessly and without thinking what is being done, a man may open himself to influences of which he is unaware, and for which he is unprepared. In using all such forms of magic, a man should be on his guard lest he carelessly open himself to unpleasant influences which might otherwise have passed him by. The student will also do well to remember that the natural effect of concentrating the mind is to produce tension in the muscles of the body, as, for example, in the knitting of the brows. Such tension not only tires the body but also acts as an obstacle to the inflow of spiritual forces. The student should, therefore, periodically in his meditation, and also in his daily life, turn his attention to his body and deliberately relax. Experience will demonstrate the immense relief to the whole system which follows even a moment of complete relaxation. People of strong and intense natures should pay special attention to relaxation, and may find it necessary to practice definite exercises with this end in view. Many books on the subject exist. Power Through Repose, by Annie Basin Cool, can be confidently recommended as one of the best. Concentration is not a matter of physical effort. The moment the mind turns to a thought, it is concentrated on it. Concentration is less a matter of holding page 128 the mind by force on a certain thought than of letting the mind continue to rest on that thought in perfect stillness and quietude. The student must bear in mind that the seat of thought is not in the brain but in the mental body, hence concentration concerns the mental body more than the physical brain. Concentration is thus obviously not a state of passivity, but, on the contrary, one of intense and regulated activity. It resembles, in the mental world, the gathering up of the muscles for a spring in the physical world, or their stiffening to meet a prolonged strain. The man who is beginning real concentration of thought should not at first exceed 5 or 10 minutes at a stretch, otherwise he is apt to overtax the brain. Very gradually the time may be lengthened to 15, 20 or 30 minutes. The student should never practice concentration or meditation to the point of making a feeling of dullness and heaviness in the brain, for dullness and pain are danger signals, indicating that the effort is being made to change the matter of the bodies more rapidly than is consistent with health. Most people appear to find it more difficult to bridle thought than emotion, probably because they have been brought up to consider it unseemly to allow emotion to disport itself unchecked, whereas they have usually allowed their thoughts to roam as fancy dictated. When a man begins to attempt to control his mind, he thus finds himself in conflict with the past habits of his mental body. Just as the collective consciousness of his astral body forms what is termed the desire elemental, see astral body, p. 77, so is there a mental elemental in his mental body. This mental elemental has thus become accustomed to have things all his own way, and to drift from subject to subject at his own sweet will. The struggle with the mental elemental is in some ways different from that which has been waged against the desire elemental. The mental elemental, being a whole stage earlier in evolution than the desire elemental, is less used to material confinement, consequently he is more active than the desire elemental, more restless, but less powerful and determined. In the nature of things, he is thus easier to manage, but less used to management, so that it takes far less actual exertion of strength to control a thought than a desire, but it needs a more persistent application of that strength. It must also be remembered that on the mental plane mind is on its own ground, and is dealing with its own matter, so that it is only a question of practice for it to learn to manage the mental elemental perfectly, whereas, when we endeavor to rule the desire elemental, we are bringing down the mind into a world which is foreign to it, and imposing an alien ascendancy from without. So important are the last few facts stated that it may be useful to recapitulate them briefly. Control of mind is in itself far easier than control of the emotions, but we have had a certain amount of practice in emotional control, and as a rule almost no practice in mind control. Hence the mental exercise seems so difficult to us. Both of them together constitute a far easier task than the perfect mastery of the physical body, But this latter we have to some extent been practicing during a number of previous lives, though our achievements along that line are even yet notably imperfect. A thorough comprehension of this matter should be distinctly encouraging to the student. One result of such comprehension should be vividly to impress upon him the truth of the remark in the voice of the silence that this earth is the only true hell which is known to the occultist. Lest the above statements may seem untrue or exaggerated, let the student consider the difficulty of banishing, by thought power, say, a raging toothache. Though even this can be done under certain conditions, it is clearly much easier by thought power to banish depression, anger, jealousy, or any other unpleasant emotion, and still easier to deflect the thought from an unpleasant or profitless subject to one more pleasing or useful, or even to stop the mind working altogether. It will now be useful to consider more in detail the obstacles to concentration. These, as we shall see, divide themselves naturally into two main groups. The first has to do with karma, or desire, the second with the very nature of mental matter itself. The difficulty in the control of mind was well expressed 5,000 years ago by Arjuna in the immortal dialogue between him and Sri Krishna, see Bhagavad Gita 34-35. This yoga which thou hast declared to be by equanimity, O slayer of Madhu, I see no stable foundation for it, owing to restlessness, for the mind is verily restless, O Krishna. It is impetuous, strong, and difficult to bend. I deem it as hard to curb as the wind. And still is true the answer pointing out the only way to success: without doubt, O mighty armed, the mind is hard to curb, but it may be curbed by constant practice, abhyasa, and by indifference, virajya. We will take the two obstacles, the remedies for which are italicized above, in the reverse order. 1. Indifference. This reference is clearly to the power of karma, or desire, to attract, sway, and hold the mind. In chapter 6 we studied in detail the relation between karma and manas, and saw the manner in which desire continually impels the mind and constantly makes it serve as a minister of pleasure. Thus is the mind induced to seek that which pleases as well as to avoid that which gives pain. Hence it is only by curbing and mastering the emotions that they can be dominated and prevented from dragging the mind away from the task it had set itself to perform. It is well that the student should remind himself that a chaos of petty emotions is unworthy of a rational being, and it is to the last degree undignified that man, who is a spark of the divine, should allow himself to fall under the sway of his desire elemental, a thing that is not even a mineral yet. There would appear to be two principal ways in which this indifference can be attained and utilized as a means to concentration. These we may term, A, the philosophical, and B, the devotional method. A. The philosophical method. This consists in so modifying and strengthening one's attitude towards everything that normally attracts and binds men that karma or desire is brought completely under control. The man thus becomes indifferent to all objects, whether external, or as presented to the mind from within. This method, as observed by the present writer, seems to be difficult to most people of Western temperament, and often tends to create more perplexities than it solves. Yet to people of Eastern temperament, to use a rough but useful distinction, it does not appear to present much difficulty. To expound the method fully would necessitate a treatise on philosophy, which of course, is far beyond the scope of the present book. Let a few words suffice to give a general idea of the method. The philosophy of the system described in Discourses 5 and 6 of the Bhagavad Gita, which are called respectively the yoga of renunciation of action and the yoga of self-subdual. Under this system the man neither hateth nor desireth. He is free from the pairs of opposites He perceives that the senses move among the objects of sense. He places all actions in the eternal, abandoning attachment. He mentally renounces all actions He looks equally on a Brahmana adorned with learning and humility, a cow, an elephant and even a dog and outcast. He neither rejoiceth on obtaining what is pleasant, nor sorroweth on obtaining what is unpleasant, semicolon. He is unattached to external contacts and findeth joy in the self, semicolon. He is able to endure. The force born from desire and passion. Harmonized. Happy. Intent on the welfare of all beings. Disjoined from desire and passion. He performeth such action as is duty, independently of the fruit of action. With the formative will renounced. Controlled and peaceful. Uniform in cold and heat, pleasure and pain, as well as honor and dishonor. He regards impartially lovers, friends and foes, strangers, neutrals, foreigners and relatives, also the righteous and unrighteous, semicolon. He is free from hope and greed. He is free from longing for all desirable things, semicolon. He is as a lamp in a windless place. He is not shaken even by heavy sorrow, semicolon. He abandons without reserve all desire born of the imagination, semicolon. Little by little he gains tranquility. Having made the mind abide in the self, semicolon. He seeth the self abiding in all beings in the self. And he is completely harmonized. The above constitutes but a bare outline of what we have termed the philosophical method. The method may, in fact, should be modified and adapted, within very wide limits, to suit the particular individual and the peculiarities of his temperament. The philosophical method, however, as already said, is for many a hard and perplexing path, as, therefore, the Dharma of another is full of danger, let such follow the second method, less drastic, now to be described. B. The devotional method. In this method, instead of attempting to eliminate karma, that is, desire or attachment, the student uses the very force of karma to fix the mind. This is, par excellence, the method of the devotee, who cultivates karma, in its highest form, to such a degree of intensity that all other attachments become relatively insignificant, and therefore powerless to disturb or distract his attention. One who is of a devotional temperament may achieve his end by fixing his mind on a beloved object, or image, the very pleasure which he experiences from a contemplation of that image serving to hold the mind fixed upon it, even if the mind be forcibly dragged away from it. It will return to it again and again. In this way a devotee attains to a considerable degree of concentration. Whilst the devotee thus utilizes the element of attraction to a person, a more philosophically minded person may take for his attractive image some profound idea, or even problem. Thus, for him, the intellectual interest, the deep desire for knowledge, provides the binding power of attraction, and so fixes the mind immovably. A useful definition of concentration, from this point of view, is as follows. The mental practice of concentration is control of mind, domination of mind by a mood, stamped upon it by the will, so that all the thinking will be bent on the purpose chosen. For those who are not definitely devotional, the above method may be considerably modified. This modified method, in fact, is perhaps for most people the easiest of all, being, in fact, what one does in ordinary daily life. It consists in becoming so interested and absorbed in the subject selected that all other thoughts are ipso facto excluded from the mind. The mind should become so engrossed as to induce a state of more or less rapt concentration. The student must learn to accomplish this at will, and will best succeed by cultivating the power and habit of observing and paying attention to outer objects. An object should be taken, examined and studied minutely in many aspects. No object in nature is in reality dull or uninteresting. If anything seems so, it is rather the failure to appreciate the wonder and beauty of its manifestation lies in our inattentiveness and lack of perception. Some degree of mastery of the above relatively elementary exercise is necessary to successful visualization, that is, the power of mentally reproducing an object in accurate detail without it being visible to the eyes. And accurate visualization is a necessary faculty in certain forms of occult work, such, for example, as ceremonial. If instead of a concrete object, an idea be chosen, egg, a virtue, it should arouse the enthusiasm and devotion of the student, the concentration in this case being chiefly that of the feelings and less conspicuously that of the mind. It is easier to be one-pointed in feeling than in thought, for thought is more subtle and active, But if concentration of feeling can be induced, the mind will to a certain extent follow suit. In the practice of concentration, as well as of meditation, the beginner is apt to find that many little unsatisfied desires and unthought-out problems, present hungry mouths ever calling aside the attention. To clear away these obstructions, it is little use trying to repress or suppress them. A better plan is to give them their due, appoint them a time, and think them out. A mind cannot overcome such vacillation as leaves its problems perpetually unsettled, cannot succeed in concentration, let alone meditation. The student must decide to arbitrate his problems, abide by his own decisions, and then refuse to think the same matter over and over again. The ability to do this grows with practice and with the habit of putting decisions into action. 2. Constant practice. The reference here seems to be the quality of restlessness, which is more or less inherent in mental matter, and in mental elemental essence. The elemental essence, in fact, is largely responsible for our wandering thoughts, as it darts constantly from one thing to another. But as mental matter is subject to the laws of habit just as is all matter, it is possible to train it, by constant practice, until it becomes habitual for it to be the reverse of restless, and thus to fashion it into the willing and obedient servant of the real man, the thinker. The quickest and best way to overcome the wanderings of the mind is, of course, to use the will. Whatever method, in fact, be chosen, the will must be used to some extent. There are some people who rely solely on the force of the will, and there is no limit to the degree to which will may be developed, whilst others prefer to assist and supplement their will power by philosophy, devotion, or by any other devices that they may be able to discover for themselves. It is, of course, possible to make a shell around oneself, and thus exclude thoughts from outside, but this method is not recommended as a permanent plan, for shells, after all, are but crutches. If, however, such a shell be employed, it must be recognized that it cannot prevent wandering thoughts from arising within the man's own mind, but it can prevent the intrusion from without of casual floating thoughts which have been left about by other people. It is advisable that only the lower mental matter be employed in the making of such a shell, as otherwise helpful thought may be kept out, or the man's own thought might be hampered as he poured it forth towards his master. In Freemasonry, the corresponding process is that of tilling the lodge, which is done, of course, on the plane appropriate to the degree which is being worked. The power of concentration can, and should be, acquired in ordinary daily life. Whatever we are doing, we should focus our whole attention upon it, do it with all our might, and as well as it can be done. A letter, for example, should be well and accurately written, no carelessness in detail being allowed to delay it or mar its effects. A book should be read with full attention, and effort to grasp the author's meaning. No day should pass without some definite exercise of the mind. For it is only by exercise that strength comes. Disuse means always weakness and atrophy. The mechanism of worry and the method of eliminating it should be grasped by the student. Work, unless excessive, does not injure the thought apparatus, but, on the contrary, strengthens it. But the mental process of worry definitely injures it, and after a time produces nervous exhaustion and irritability, which renders steady mental work impossible. Worry is the process of repeating the same train of thought over and over again with small alterations, coming to no result, and often not even aiming at a result. It is the continued reproduction of thought forms initiated by the mental body and the brain, not by the consciousness, and imposed by them on the consciousness. The thinker, having failed to solve his problem, remains unsatisfied. Fear of anticipated trouble keeps him in an anxious and restless condition. Under this impulse, which is undirected by the thinker, the mental body and brain continue to throw up images which have already been shaped and rejected. In worry, the thinker is the slave instead of the master of his bodies. Worry being largely due to automatism, the same property of matter can be utilized to overcome it. Perhaps the best way to get rid of a worry channel is to dig another of an exactly opposite character. This may be done by dwelling in meditation on such a thought as the self is peace, that self am I. The self is strength, that self am I. As he thus broods, The peace he is contemplating will enfold him, and he will be filled with the strength he has pictured to himself in thought. The precise formulation of ideas for the meditation can, of course, be suited to the particular individual. The student must learn not only to think, but also to cease thinking at will. When the work of thought is over, it should be dropped completely and not allowed to drift on vaguely, touching the mind and leaving it, like a boat knocking itself against a rock. A man does not keep a machine running when it is not turning at work, needlessly wearing the machinery. Similarly, the priceless machinery of the mind should not be permitted to turn and turn aimlessly, wearing itself out without useful result. Just as tired limbs luxuriate in complete repose, so may the mind find comfort in complete rest. When the student has finished his thought work, he should drop the thought, and then as other thoughts appear in the mind, turn his attention away from them. Another method, which the present writer employs with success, is not so much to turn the attention away, this itself being a positive act, as to take not interest in thoughts that arise. Let them come as they will, but be entirely indifferent to them. After a short time, no fresh life being infused into them, they cease to appear, and a complete stillness, entirely free from thought of any kind, is experienced, which is exceedingly restful, both to the astral and the mental bodies. This plan may be used also to cure sleeplessness. The present writer has found it invaluable in many instances. Cessation of thought is a necessary preliminary to work on the higher planes. When the brain has learned to be quiescent, then there opens the possibility of withdrawing the consciousness from its physical vesture. The student will now be in a position to understand the full force of the aphorism of Patanjali that, for the practice of yoga, the man must stop the modifications of the thinking principle. The task to be achieved is to acquire such perfect control over the mental body, or thinking principle, that it can be modified only with consent, deliberately given, of the man himself, the thinker. The term used by Patanjali in defining yoga is chittavritti nirodha, which means restraint, nirodha, of the whirlpools, viritti, of the mind, chitta. A man must be able to take up and lay down the mind as one does a tool. When that stage is reached, then the possibility arises for the man to withdraw altogether from the mental body. Yoga is thus the inhibition of all vibrations and changes in the mental body. Hence, in the mental body of a master there is no change of color save as initiated from within. The color of his mental body is as moonlight on a rippling ocean. Within that whiteness lie all possibilities of color, but nothing in the outer world can make the faintest change of hue sweep over its steady radiance. His mental body is merely an outer sheath that he uses when he needs to communicate with the lower world. A result of concentration is that as the knower, with concentrated mind, steadily contemplates the one image, he obtains a fuller knowledge of the object than he could obtain by means of any verbal description of it. The rough outline produced by the word description of an object is filled in more and more detail as the picture is shaped in the mental body, and the consciousness comes more and more into touch with the things described. For further details of the theory and practice of concentration and thought power, the student is referred to Thought Power, Its Control and Culture, by Annie Besant, and for a practical manual on concentration, to Mr. Ernest Wood's admirable book Concentration. Chapter 16 Meditation. Concentration is, of course, not an end in itself, but a means to an end. Concentration fashions the mind into an instrument which can be used at the will of the owner. When a concentrated mind is steadily directed to any object, with a view to piercing the veil and reaching the life, and drawing that life into union with the life to which the mind belongs, then meditation is performed. Concentration is thus the shaping of the organ, meditation is its exercise. As we have seen, concentration means the firm fixing of the mind on one single point without wandering, and without yielding to any distractions caused by external objects, by the activity of the senses or by that of the mind itself. It must be braced up to an unswerving steadiness and fixity, until gradually it will learn so to withdraw its attention from the outer world and from the body that the senses will remain quiet and still, while the mind is intensely alive and all its energies drawn inwards, to be launched at a single point of thought, the highest to which it can attain. When it is able to hold itself thus with comparative ease, it is ready for a further step, and by a strong but calm effort of the will it can throw itself beyond the highest thought it can reach, while working in the physical brain, and in that effort will rise to, and unite itself with, the higher consciousness, and find itself free of the body.